Chapter 11. All Else Truth. 1. "Bring the prisoners forward," said Captain Drakasha. It was full night on the deck of the Poison Orchid, and the ship rode at anchor beneath a star-pierced sky. The moons had not yet begun to rise. Drakasha stood at the quarterdeck rail, backlit by alchemical lamps, wearing a tarpaulin for a cloak. Her hair was covered by a ludicrous woolen wig, vaguely resembling the ceremonial hairpiece of a Verari magistrate. The deck, fore and aft, was crowded with shadowed crewfolk, and in a small, clear space amidships stood the prisoners. 19 men from the Red Messenger had survived the morning's fight. Now all 19 stood, bound hands and feet, in an awkward bunch at the ship's waist. Locke shuffled forward behind Jean and Jabril. "Clerk of the court," said Drakasha, "you have brought us a sad lot." "A sad lot indeed, Your Honor." Lieutenant Del Mastro appeared beside the captain, clutching a rolled scroll and wearing a ridiculous wig of her own. "As wretched a pack of dissolute, cockless mongrels as I've ever seen. Still, I suppose we must try them."
"Indeed we must, ma'am."
"With what are they charged?"
"Such a litany of crimes as turns the blood to jam."
Del Mastro opened the scroll and raised her voice as she read.
"Wilful refusal of the kind hospitality of the Archon of Tal Verar. Deliberate flight from the excellent accommodations provided by said Archon at Windward Rock. Theft of a naval vessel with the stated intention of applying it to a life of piracy."
"Disgraceful."
"Just so, Your Honor. Now the next bit is rather confusing. Some are charged with mutiny, while others are charged with incompetence."
"Some this, some that. Clerk of the court, we cannot abide untidiness. Simply charge everyone with everything."
"Understood. The mutineers are now incompetent, and the incompetent are also mutineers."
"Excellent. Very excellent. And so very magisterial. No doubt I shall be quoted in books."
"Important books too, ma'am."
"What else do these wretches have to answer for?"
"Assault and larceny beneath the red flag, Your Honor. Armed piracy on the Sea of Brass on the 21st instant of the month of Festal, this very year."
"Vile, grotesque, and contemptible," shouted Drakasha. "Let the record show that I feel as though I may swoon. Tell me, are there any who would speak in defense of the prisoners?"
"None, ma'am, as the prisoners are penniless."
"Ah, then under whose laws do they claim any rights or protections?"
"None, ma'am. No power on land will claim or aid them."
"Pathetic and not unexpected. Yet without firm guidance from their betters, perhaps it's only natural that these rodents have shunned virtue like a contagious disease. Perhaps some small chance of clemency may be forthcoming."
"Unlikely, ma'am."
"One small matter remains, which may attest to their true character. Clerk of the court, can you describe the nature of their associates and consorts?"
"Only too vividly, Your Honor. They willfully consort with the officers and crew of the Poison Orchid."
"Gods above!" cried Drakasha. "Did you say Poison Orchid?"
"I did indeed, ma'am."
"They are guilty. Guilty on every count. Guilty in every particular. Guilty to the utmost and final extremity of all possible human culpability."
Drakasha tore at her wig, then flung it to the deck and jumped up and down upon it.
"An excellent verdict, ma'am."
"It is the judgment of this court," said Drakasha, "solemn in its authority and unwavering in its resolution, that for crimes upon the sea shall have them. Put them over the side, and may the gods not be too hasty in conferring mercy upon their souls."
Cheering, the crew surged forth from every direction and surrounded the prisoners. Locke was alternately pushed and pulled along with the crowd to the larboard entry port, where a cargo net lay upon the deck with a sail beneath it. The two were lashed together at the edges. The ex-messengers were shoved onto the netting and held there, while several dozen sailors under Del Mastro's direction moved to the capstan.
"Make ready to execute sentence," said Dracasha. "Heave up," cried Del Mastro.
A complex network of pulleys and tackles had been rigged between the lower yards of the foremast and mainmast. As the sailors worked the capstan, the edges of the net drew upward, and the orchids holding the prisoners stepped back. In a few seconds, the ex-messengers were off the deck, squeezed together like animals in a trap. Locke clung to the rough netting to avoid slipping into the center of the tangled mass of limbs and bodies. There was a generally useless bout of shoving and swearing as the net swung out over the rail and swayed gently in the darkness 15 feet above the water.
"Clerk of the court, execute the prisoners," said Dracasha. "Give 'em a drop, aye."
They wouldn't, thought Locke. At the very same moment they did. The net full of prisoners plunged, drawing unwilling yelps and screams from the throats of men who'd done murderous battle on the Kingfisher in relative silence. The pull on the edges of the net slackened as it fell, so at least they had more room to tumble and bounce when they hit the surface of the water, or, more accurately, the strangely yielding barrier of net and sail canvas with the water beneath it like a cushion. They rolled around in a jumbled, shouting mass for a second or two while the edges of their traps settled down into the waves, and then the warm, dark water was pouring in around them. Locke felt a brief moment of genuine panic, hard not to when the knots binding hands and feet were very real, but after a few moments the edges of the net-backed sail began to draw upward again until they were just above the surface of the ocean. The water still trapped with the prisoners was about waist deep to Locke, and now the sail canvas formed a sort of shielded pool for them to stand and flounder about in.
"Everyone all right?"
That was Jean. Locke saw that he'd claimed the edge of the net directly across from him. There were half a dozen shoving, splashing men between them. Locke scowled at the realization that Jean was quite content to stay where he was.
"Fucking jolly,"
muttered Streber, holding himself upright by one arm. The other had been lashed to the front of his chest in a crude sling. Several of the ex-messengers were nursing broken bones, and nearly all of them had cuts and bruises, but not one had been excused from this ritual by his injuries.
"Your Honor!"
Locke glanced up at the sound of Del Mastro's voice. The lieutenant was peering down at them from the larboard entry port with a lantern in one hand. Their net was resting in the water 3 or 4 feet from the orchid's dark hull.
"Your Honor, they're not drowning!"
"What?" Dracasha appeared next to Del Mastro with her false wig back on her head, now more wildly askew than ever.
"You rude little bastards! How dare you waste this court's time with this ridiculous refusal to be executed? Clerk, help them drown!" "Aye, ma'am! Immediate drowning assistance! Deck pumps at the ready! Deck pumps away!"
A pair of sailors appeared at the rail with the aperture of a canvas hose held between them. Locke turned away just as the gush of warm salt water started pounding down on them all. Not so bad, he thought, just seconds before something more substantial than water struck the back of his head with a wet, stinging smack. Bombardment with this new indignity, greased oakum, Locke quickly realized, was general and vigorous. Crewfolk had lined the rail and were flinging it down into the netted prisoners, a veritable rain of rags and rope fragments that had the familiar rancid stink of the stuff he'd spent several mornings painting the masts with. This assault continued for several minutes, until Locke had no idea where the grease ended and his clothes began, and the water in their little enclosure was topped with a sliding layer of foulness.
"Unbelievable!" shouted Del Mastro. "Your Honor, they're still there!" "Not drowned?"
Zamira appeared at the rail once again and solemnly removed her wig.
"Damnation! The sea refuses to claim them! We shall have to bring them back aboard."
After a few moments, the lines above them drew taut, and the little prison of net and canvas began to rise from the water. Not a moment too soon, it seemed. Locke shuddered as he felt something large and powerful brush against the barrier beneath his feet. In seconds, they were mercifully above the tips of the waves and creaking steadily upward. But their punishment was not yet over. They hung once more in the darkness when the net was hoisted above the rail and were not brought back in above the deck.
"Free the spinning tackle!" shouted Del Mastro.
Locke caught sight of a small woman shimmying out onto the tangle of ropes overhead. She pulled a restraining pin from the large wooden tackle by which the net was suspended. Locke recognized the circular metal bearing within the tackle. Heavily greased, it would allow even awkward and weighty cargoes to be spun with ease. Cargoes like them. Crewfolk lined the rail and began to grab at the net and heave it along. In moments, the prisoners were spinning at a nauseating rate, and the world around them flew by in glimpses. Dark water, lamps on the deck, dark water, lamps on the deck.
"Oh, gods!"
said someone, a moment before he noisily threw up. There was a sudden scramble away from the poor fellow, and Locke clung grimly to his place at the edge of the net, trying to ignore the kicking, shuddering, spinning mass of men.
"Clean 'em up!" shouted Del Mastro. "Deck pumps away!"
The hard stream of salt water gushed into their midst once more, and they spun furiously. Locke intersected the spray every few seconds as each rotation of the net brought him around. His dizziness grew and grew as the minutes passed, and though it was becoming extremely fashionable, he focused every speck of dignity on simply not throwing up. So intense was his dizziness and so swift was their deliverance that he didn't even realize they'd been swung back onto the deck until the net he was clinging to collapsed into slackness. He toppled forward onto netting and canvas above good hard planks once again. The net had ceased spinning, but the world took its place, rotating in six or seven directions at once, all of them profoundly unpleasant. Locke closed his eyes, but that didn't help. It merely made him blind as well as nauseous. Men were crawling over him, moaning and swearing. A pair of crewfolk reached down and heaved Locke to his feet. His stomach nearly surrendered at that point, and he coughed sharply to fight back his nausea. Captain Drakasha was approaching, her false wig and cloak discarded, and she was tilted at a funny angle.
"The sea won't have you," she said. "The water refuses to swallow you. It's not yet your time to drown, praise Yono. Praise Ulcris!"
Ulcris was the Jereshti name for the god of the sea, not often heard in Therin lands or waters. There must be more Eastern Islanders aboard than I realized, thought Locke.
"Lord of the grasping waters, shield us," chanted the crew. "So you're here with us between all things," said Drakasha. "The land won't have you and the sea won't claim you. You fled, like us, to wood and canvas. This deck's your firmament. These sails are your heavens. This is all the world you get. This is all the world you need."
She stepped forward with a drawn dagger.
"Will you lick my boots to claim a place on it?"
"No!"
the ex-messengers roared in unison. They'd been coached on this part of the ritual.
"Will you kneel and kiss my jeweled ring for mercy?"
"No."
"Will you bend your knees to pretty titles on pieces of paper?"
"No."
"Will you pine for land and laws and kings and cling to them like a mother's tit?"
"No."
She stepped up to Locke and handed him the dagger.
"Then free yourself, brother."
Still unsteady and grateful for the aid of the crewfolk beside him, Locke used the blade to saw through the rope that bound his hands, and then bent over to cut the rope between his ankles. That accomplished, he turned and saw that all of the ex-messengers were more or less upright, most of them held by one or two orchids. Close at hand, he could see several familiar faces. Streva, Jabril, a fellow called Alvaro, and just behind them, Jean, watching him uneasily. Locke hesitated, then pointed to Jabril and held out the blade. Free yourself, brother. Jabril smiled, took the blade, and was finished with his bonds in a moment. Jean glared at him. Locke closed his eyes, not wanting to make further eye contact, and listened as the dagger made its passage through the group, from hand to hand. Free yourself, brother, they murmured, one after another, and then it was done. Unbound by your own hands, you are outlaw brethren of the Sea of Brass, said Captain Drakasha, and crewmen of the Poison Orchid. 2. Even an experienced thief will find occasion to learn new tricks if he lives long enough. That morning and afternoon, Locke had learned how to properly loot a captured ship. Locke finished his last circuit below decks, reasonably certain there were no more Kingfisher crew folk to round up, and stomped up the companionway to the quarterdeck. The bodies of the Redeemers there had been moved aside and stacked at the taffrail. The bodies of those from the Poison Orchid had been carried down to the waist. Locke could see several of Zamira's crew folk respectfully covering them with sail canvas. He quickly surveyed the ship. 30 or 40 Orchids had come aboard and were taking control of the vessel everywhere. They were up the ratlines, with Jean Del Mastro at the wheel, tending the anchors and guarding the 30 or so surviving Kingfisher crewfolk atop the forecastle deck. Under Utgar's supervision, the wounded Kingfishers and Orchids had been carried down to the waist near the starboard entry port, where Captain Drakasha and Scholar Tregane were just coming aboard. Locke hurried toward them.
"It's my arm, Scholar. Hurts something awful."
Streva used his good arm to support his injured limb as he winced and held it out for Tregane's inspection.
"I think it's broken." "Of course it's broken, you cretinous turd,"
she said, brushing past him to kneel beside a Kingfisher whose tunic was completely soaked in blood.
"Keep waving it like that and it'll snap right off. Sit down." "But—" "I work from worst chance to best," Tregane muttered.
She knelt on the deck beside the injured Kingfisher, using her cane to brace herself until she was on both knees. Then she gave the cane a twist. The handle separated from the cane's full length, revealing a dagger-sized blade that Tregane used to slice the sailor's tunic open.
"I can move you up on my list by kicking your head a couple of times. Still want prompt attention?"
No.
You'll keep. Piss off.
There you are, Ravel. Captain Drakasha stepped past Tregane and the injured and grabbed Locke by the shoulder.
You've done well for yourself.
Have I?
You're as useless as an ass without a hole when it comes to running a ship, but I've heard the damnedest things about how you fought just now.
Your sources exaggerate.
Well, the ship's ours, and you gave us her master. Now that we've plucked our flower, we need to sip the nectar before bad weather or another ship comes along.
Will you be taking the Kingfisher as a prize?
No. I don't like having more than one prize crew out at a time. We'll shake her down for valuables and useful cargo.
Then burn her or something?
Of course not. We'll leave the crew stores enough to make port and watch them scamper for the horizon. You look confused.
No objections, Captain. It's just not as downright bastardly as I was expecting.
You don't think we respect surrenders because we're kindly people, do you, Ravel?
Drakasha grinned.
I don't have much time to explain, but it's like this. If not for those gods-damned redeemers, these people...
She waved a hand at the injured Kingfishers waiting for Dragan's attention. "Wouldn't have given or taken a scratch.
4 out of 5 ships we take, I'd say. If they can't rig razor nets and get bows ready, they just roll right over for it. They know we'll let 'em slip off with their lives once we're done. And the common sailors don't own 1 centira of the cargo, so why should they swallow a blade or a crossbow bolt for it?
I guess it does make sense.
To more people than us. Look at this shambles. Redeemers for security? If those maniacs hadn't been available for free, this ship wouldn't have any real guards. I guarantee it. No sense in it for the owners. These long voyages, 4 or 5 months from the Far East back to Talvara with spices, rare metals, wood, an owner can lose 2 ships out of 3, and the one that arrives will pay for the 2 that don't, with profit to spare. And if they get the actual ship back, even sans cargo, so much the better. That's why we don't sink and burn like mad. As long as we show some restraint and don't get too close to civilization, the folks holding the purse strings think of us as a natural hazard like the weather. So with the, plucking and sipping the nectar bit, where do we start?
Most worthwhile thing at hand is the ship's purse, said Drakasha. Master keeps it for expenses, bribes and so forth. Finding it's always a pain in the ass. Some throw it overboard, others hide it somewhere dank and unlikely. We'll probably have to slap this Nera around for a few hours before he spits truth.
Damnation!
Behind them, Tregan let her patience slump to the deck and began wiping her bloody hands on his breeches.
No good on this one, Captain. I can see straight through to his lungs behind the wound.
He's dead for sure, said Locke.
Well, heavens, I wouldn't know. I'm just the fucking physicker. But I heard in a bar once that dead is the accepted thing to be when your lungs are open to daylight, said Tregan.
Yes, I heard the same thing. Look, will anyone else here die without your immediate full attention?
Not likely.
Captain Drakasha, said Locke, Master Nera has something of a soft heart. Might I take the liberty of suggesting a plan?
A few moments later, Locke returned to the waist, holding Antoro Nera by one arm. The man's hands had been bound behind his back. Locke gave him a good shove towards Amira, who stood with one sabre unsheathed. Behind her, Tregan worked feverishly over the corpse of the newly deceased sailor. The slashed and bloody tunic had been disposed of, and a clean one drawn over the corpse's chest. Only a small red spot now marked the lethal wound, and Tregan gave every impression that the unmoving form was still within her power to save. Drakasha caught Nera and set her blade against his upper chest.
"Please to make your acquaintance," she said, sliding the curved edge of her weapon toward Nera's unprotected neck. He whimpered. "Your ship's badly out of trim. Too much weight of gold. We need to find and remove the master's purse as quick as we can."
"I, don't know exactly where it is," said Nera.
"Right, and I can teach fish to fart fire," said Drakasha. "You get one more chance, and then I start throwing your injured overboard."
"But, please, I was told..."
"Whoever told you anything wasn't me."
I don't..."
"Scholar," said Drakasha, "can you do anything for the man you're working on?"
"He won't be dancing any time soon," said Tregan. "But yes, he'll pull through."
Drakasha shifted her grip on Nera and held him by his tunic collar with her free hand. She took 2 steps to her right and, barely looking, drove her sabre down into the dead sailor's neck. Tregan flinched backward and gave the corpse's legs a little push to make it look as though they'd kicked. Nera gasped.
"Medicine is such an uncertain business," said Drakasha.
"In my cabin," said Nera. "A hidden compartment by the compass above my bed. Please, please don't kill any more of..."
"I didn't, actually," said Drakasha.
She withdrew her sabre from the corpse's throat, wiped it on Nera's breeches, and gave him a quick kiss on the cheek.
"Your man died a few minutes ago. My leech says she can save the rest of your injured without trouble."
She spun Nera around, slashed the rope that bound his hands, and shoved him toward Locke with a grin.
"Return him to his people, Ravel, and then kindly relieve his secret compartment of its burden."
"Your will, Captain."
After that, they began taking the kingfisher apart more eagerly than newlyweds tearing off layers of formal clothing in their first moment of privacy. Locke felt his fatigue vanishing as he became absorbed in what was essentially one vast robbery for more physical material than he'd ever stolen before in his life. He was passed from duty to duty among orchids who laughed and clowned with real spirit, but worked with haste and precision for all that. First they snatched up anything portable and reasonably valuable, bottles of wine, Master Nera's formal wardrobe, bags of coffee and tea from the galley, and several crossbows from the Kingfisher's tiny armory. Drakasha herself appraised the ship's collection of navigational instruments and hourglasses, leaving Nera the bare minimum required to safely work his vessel back to port. Next, Utgard and the bosun scoured the flute from stem to stern, using the surviving scrub watch as mules to haul off stores and equipment of nautical use, alchemical cork, good sail canvas, carpenter's tools, barrels of pitch, and loop after loop of new rope.
"Good shit, hey!"
said Utgard as he weighed Locke down with about 50 pounds of rope and a box of metal files.
"Much too expensive in Port Prodigal. Always best to get it at what we call the broadside discount."
Last but not least came the Kingfisher's cargo. All the main deck hatch gratings were pulled, and a nearly incomprehensible network of ropes and pulleys was rigged on and between the two ships. By noon, crates and casks and oilcloth-wrapped bundles were being lighted along to the poison orchid. It was everything Nera had promised and more. Turpentine, oiled witchwood, silks, crates of fine yellow wine padded with sheepskins, and barrel after barrel of bulk spices. The smell of cloves, nutmeg, and ginger filled the air. After an hour or two of work at the hoists, Locke was brown with a sludge that was half sweat and half powdered cinnamon. At the fifth hour of the afternoon, Drakasha called a halt to the forcible transfusion of wealth. The poison orchid rode lower in the gleaming water, and the lightened flute rolled freely, hollowed out like an insect husk about to fall from a spider's jaws. Drakasha's crew hadn't stripped her clean, of course. They left the Kingfishers their casks of water, salted meat, cheap ale, and pink piss ration wine. They even left a few crates and parcels of valuables that were too deeply or inconveniently stowed for Drakasha's taste. Nonetheless, the sack was thorough. Any land-bound merchant would have been well pleased to have a ship unloaded at the dock with such haste. A brief ceremony was held at the taffrail of the Kingfisher. Zamira blessed the dead of the two vessels in her capacity as a lay priestess of Yono. Then the corpses went over the side, sewn into old canvas with Redeemer weapons weighing them down. The Redeemers themselves were then thrown overboard without a word.
"Ain't disrespectful,"
said Utgard when Locke whispered to him about this.
"Far as they believe, they get consecrated and blessed and all that fine stuff by their own gods the moment they die. No hard feelings if you just tip the heathens over the side afterward. Helpful thing to know if you ever have to kill a bunch of 'em again, eh?"
At last the day's long business was truly concluded. Master Nera and his crew were released to tend to their own fortunes once again. While Drakasha's archers kept watch from their perches on the yardarms, the network of lines and fend-offs between the two ships was pulled apart. The poison orchid hauled up her boats and loosed her sails. In minutes she was making 7 or 8 knots to the southwest, leaving the Kingfisher adrift in disarray behind her. Locke had seen little of Jean all day, and both of them had seemed to work to studiously preserve their separation. Just as Locke had thrown himself into manual labour, Jean had remained with Delmastro on the quarterdeck. They didn't come close enough to speak again until the sun fell beneath the horizon, and the scrub watch was herded together and bound for their initiation. 3. All the new initiates and half the ship's old company were on the merry watch, fueled by rack after rack of the fine eastern wines they'd plucked from the Kingfisher. Locke recognized some of the labels and vintages. Stuff that wouldn't sell in Camor for less than 20 crowns a bottle was being sucked down like beer, or poured into the hair of celebrating men and women, or simply spilled on deck. The orchids, men and women alike, were mixing eagerly with the ex-messengers now. Dice games and wrestling matches and song circles had erupted spontaneously. Propositions spoken and unspoken were everywhere. Jabril had vanished below decks with a crew woman at least an hour before. Locke took it all in from the shadows of the starboard side, just below the raised quarterdeck. The starboard stairs weren't flush with the rail. There was space enough for a lean person to wedge comfortably between the two. Ravel had been greeted warmly and eagerly enough when he'd circulated on deck, but now that he'd found a cozy exile, nobody seemed to be missing him. In his hands was a large leather jack full of blue wine that was worth its weight in silver, untouched. Across the great mass of laughing, drinking sailors, Locke could make out Jean at the ship's opposite rail. While Locke watched, the shape of a woman, much shorter, approached him from behind and reached out toward him. Locke turned away. The water slipped past, a black gel topped with curls of faintly phosphorescent foam. The Orchid was setting a good pace through the night. Laden, she yielded less than before to the chop of the sea, and was parting these little waves like they were air. "When I was a lieutenant apprentice," said Captain Drakasha, "on my first voyage with an officer's sword, I lied to my captain about stealing a bottle of wine." She spoke softly. Startled, Locke looked around and saw that she was standing directly over him at the forward quarterdeck rail. "Not just me," she continued, "all eight of us in the apprentice's berth. We borrowed it from the captain's private stores and should have been smart enough to pitch it over the side when we'd finished."
"In the Navy of Cyrun, this was?"
"Her Resplendent Majesty's Sea Forces of Cyrun Eternal."
Drakasha's smile was a crescent of white against darkness, faint as the foam topping the waves.
"The captain could have had us whipped, or reduced in rank, or even chained up for formal trial on land. Instead, she had us strike down the royal yard from the mainmast. We had a spare, of course, but she made us scrape the varnish off the one we'd taken down. This is a spar of oak, you know, 10 feet long and thick as a leg. The captain took our swords and said they'd be restored if, and only if, we ate the royal yard. Tip to tip, every last splinter."
"Ate it?"
"A foot and a quarter of sturdy oak for each of us," said Drakasha. "How we did it was our business. It took a month. We tried everything, shaving it, scraping it, boiling it, pulping it. We had 100 tricks to make it palatable, and we forced it down, a few spoonfuls or chips a day. Most of us got sick, but we ate the yard."
"Gods!"
"When it was over, the captain said she'd wanted us to understand that lies between shipmates tear the ship apart, bit by bit, gnawing at it just as we'd gnawed the royal yard down to nothing."
"Ah!"
Locke sighed and at last took a sip of his warm, excellent wine.
"I take it this means I'm due for a bit more dissection, then?
Come join me at the taffrail."
Locke rose, knowing it wasn't a request.
4. "I never knew that dispensing justice could be so tiring," said Ezri, appearing at Jean's right elbow as he stood staring out over the Orchid's larboard rail.
One of the moons was just starting to rise in the south, half a silver-white coin peeking above the night horizon, as though lazily considering whether it was worth rising at all.
"You've had a long day, Lieutenant," Jean smiled.
"Jerome," she said, reaching out to set a hand upon his right forearm, "if you call me Lieutenant again tonight, I'll kill you."
"As you wish, Lou. La, something or other, Lieutenant that starts with Lou. Honest. Besides, you already tried to execute me once this evening. Look how that turned out."
"Best way possible," she said, now leaning against the rail beside him.
She wasn't wearing her armor, just a thin tunic and a pair of calf-length breeches without hose or shoes. Her hair was free, waves of dark curls rustling in the breeze.
Jean realized that she was putting most of her weight against the rail and trying hard not to show it.
You got a little too close to a few blades today, he said.
I've been closer. But you now, you're a very good fighter. Do you know that?
It's been
Gods, how wretched was that? Of course you're a good fighter. I meant to say something much wittier, honest.
Then consider it said.
Jean scratched his beard and felt a warm, welcome sort of nervousness fluttering in his stomach.
We can both pretend. All of the, effortlessly witty nonsense I've been practicing on the barrels in the hold for days has taken flight, too.
Practicing,
Yeah, well, that Jabril, he's a sophisticated fellow, isn't he? Need a bit of conversation to catch his attention, won't I?
What?
Didn't you know I only fancied men, tall men?
Ooh, I kicked you to the deck once, Valora, and I'm about to...
Ah, in your condition?
My condition is the only thing saving your life at the moment.
You wouldn't dare heap abuse on me in front of half the crew.
Of course I would.
Well, yes, true.
Look at this lovely, noisy mess. I don't think anyone would even notice if I set you on fire. Hell, down in the main deck hold, there's couples going at it packed tighter than spears in the arms lockers. You want real peace and quiet any time tonight? Closest place you might find it is 200 or 300 yards off one of the bows.
No thanks. I don't know how to say stop eating me in shark.
Well then, you're stuck here with us. And we've been waiting for you lot to get off the scrub watch for long enough. She grinned up at him. Tonight everyone gets to know everyone else.
Jean stared at her, eyes wide, not knowing what to say or do next. Her grin became a frown.
Jerome, am I doing something wrong?
Wrong?
You keep sort of moving away, not just with your body, but with your neck. You keep...
Oh, hell.
Jean laughed, reached out to put a hand on her shoulder, and felt himself burst into an uncontrollable twit grin when she reached up to hold it there.
Ezri, I lost my optics when you made a swim the day we came aboard. I'm what they call near blind. I guess I didn't realize it, but I've been fidgeting to keep you in focus.
Oh, gods, she whispered. I'm sorry.
Don't be. Keeping you in focus is worth the trouble.
I didn't mean...
I know.
Jean felt the anxious pressure in his stomach migrating upward to fill his chest, and he took a deep breath.
Look, we almost got killed today. Fuck these games. Do you want to have a drink with me?
5.
Watch, said Drakasha. Locke stood at the taffrail, looking down into the ship's phosphorescent wake between the glow of 2 stern lanterns. Those lanterns were glowing glass orchids the size of his head, transparent petals drooping delicately toward the water.
Gods, said Locke, shuddering.
Between the wake and the lanterns, there was just enough light for him to spot it, a long black shadow sliding beneath the poison orchid's trail of disturbed water. 40 or 50 feet of something sinuous and sinister, using the ship's wake to conceal itself. Captain Drakasha had one boot up on the taffrail and an expression of casual pleasure on her face.
What the hell is it?
5 or 6 possibilities, said Drakasha. Might be a whale worm or a giant devilfish.
Is it following us?
Yes.
Is it, dangerous?
Well, if you drop your drink over the rail, don't jump in after it.
Don't you think you should maybe let it have a few arrows?
I might, if only I was sure that this was the fastest it could swim.
Good point.
Fling arrows at all the strange things you see out here, Ravel, and all you do is run out of arrows. She sighed and glanced around to ensure that they were more or less alone. The closest crewman was at the wheel, 8 or 9 yards forward.
"You made yourself very useful today."
Well, the alternative just didn't suit.
"I thought I was abetting a suicide when I agreed to let you lead the boats."
"You nearly were, Captain. It was... Look, it was inches from disaster the whole way, that fight. I don't even remember half of it. The gods blessed me by allowing me to avoid soiling my breeches. Surely you know what it's like."
"I do. I also know that sometimes these things aren't accidents. You and Master Valora have excited a great deal of comment for what you did in that battle. Your skills are unusual for a former master of weights and measures."
"Weighing and measuring is a boring occupation," said Locke. "A man needs a hobby."
"The Archon's people didn't hire you by accident, did they?"
"What?"
"I said I'd peel this strange fruit you call a story, Ravel, and I have been. My initial impression of you wasn't favorable, but you've done better. And I think I can understand how you kept your old crew in thrall despite your ignorance. You seem to have a real talent for improvised dishonesty."
"Weighing and measuring is a very, very boring..."
"So, you're a master of a sedentary occupation who just happened to have a talent for espionage and disguise and command, not to mention your skill at arms or that of your close and unusually educated friend Jerome.
Our mothers were so very proud of us."
"You weren't hired away from the Priory by the Archon," said Drakasha. "You were double agents, planted provocateurs, intended to enter the Archon's service. You didn't steal that ship because of some insult you won't speak of. You stole it because your orders were to damage the Archon's credibility, to do something big."
Please, Ravel, as if there could be any other reasonable explanation. Gods, what a temptation, Locke thought. A mark actually inviting me to step into her own misconception, free and clear. He stared at the phosphorescent wake, at the mysterious something swimming beneath it. What to do? Take the opening, cement the Ravel and Valora identities in Drakasha's mind, work from there? Or, his cheeks burned as the sting of Jean's rebuke rose again in his memory. Jean hadn't just criticized him on theological grounds or because of Del Mastro. It was a matter of approaches. Which would be more effective? Treat this woman as a mark or treat her as an ally? Time was running out. This conversation was the point of decision. Follow his instincts and play her, or follow Jean's advice and attempt to trust her? He thought furiously. His own instincts... were they always impeccable? Jean's instincts, arguments aside, had Jean ever done anything but try to protect him? "Tell me something," he said very slowly, "while I weigh a response."
"Perhaps."
"Something half the size of this ship is probably staring at us as we speak."
"Yes."
"How do you stand it?"
"You see things like this often enough, you get used."
"Not just that. Everything. I've been at sea a grand total of 6 or 7 weeks in my life. How long have you been out here?" She stared at him, saying nothing.
"Some things about myself," said Locke, "I won't tell you just because you're the captain of this ship, even if you throw me back in the hold or pitch me over the side. Some things... I want to know who I'm talking to first. I want to talk to Zamira, not to Captain Drakasha."
Still she remained silent.
"Is that asking so very much?" "I'm 39, she said at last, very quietly. "I first sailed when I was 11.
"Nearly 30 years, then. Well, like I said, I've been out here a few weeks, and in that time... storms, mutiny, seasickness, battles, flit wraiths, hungry damn things lurking all over the place, waiting for someone to dip a toe in the water. It's not that I haven't enjoyed myself at times. I have. I've learned things. But 30 years? And children as well? Don't you find it all chancy?
Do you have children, Orin?
No.
The instant I decide that you are presuming to lecture me on their behalf, this conversation will end with you going over this rail to make the acquaintance of whatever's down there.
That's not at all what I meant. It's just, have people on land acquired the secret of living forever? Have they abolished accidents? Have they ceased to have weather in my absence?
Of course not.
How much more danger are my children truly in than some poor bastard conscripted to fight in his duke's wars? Or some penniless family dying of a plague with their neighborhood quarantined or burnt to the ground? Wars, disease, taxes, bowing heads and kissing boots. There's plenty of hungry damn things prowling on land, Orin. It's just that the ones at sea tend not to wear crowns.
Ah. Was your life a paradise before you sailed the Sea of Brass?
No.
Of course not. Listen well. I thought that I'd grown up in a hierarchy where mere competence and loyalty were enough to maintain one's station in life, she whispered. I gave an oath of service and imagined that oath was binding in both directions. I was a fool, and I had to kill an awful lot of men and women to escape the consequences of that foolishness. Would you really ask me to place my trust and my hopes for Paolo and Cosetta in the same bullshit that nearly killed me before? Which system of laws should I bend to, Orin? Which king or duke or empress should I trust like a mother? Which of them is a better judge of my life's worth than I am? Can you point them out to me? Write a letter of introduction?
Samira, said Locke, please don't make me out to be some sort of advocate for things that I'm not. It seems to me that my whole life has been spent in the willful disdain of what you're talking about. Do I strike you as a law and order sort of fellow?
Admittedly not.
I'm just curious, is all. I do appreciate this. Tell me now, what about the Free Armada, your so-called war for recognition? Why profess such hatred for laws and taxes and all those strictures if that was essentially what you were fighting to emplace down here?
Ah,
Zamira sighed, removed her four-cornered hat, and ran her fingers through her breeze-tossed hair.
Our infamous lost cause, our personal contribution to the glorious history of Tal Verar.
Why did you start it?
Bad judgment. We all hoped, well, Captain Bonaire was persuasive. We had a leader, a plan, open mines on new islands, tap some of the safe forests for wood and resin, pillage as we liked until the other powers on the Sea of Brass came wringing their hands to the bargaining table, and then beat the shit out of them with authorized trade. We imagined a realm without tariffs, Montier and Port Prodigal swelling up with merchants and their imported fortunes.
Ambitious.
Idiotic. I was newly escaped from one sour allegiance and I leapt right into another. We believed Bonaire when she said that Stragos didn't have the clout to come down and mount a serious fight.
Oh, hell.
They met us at sea. Biggest action I ever saw, and the soonest lost. Stragos put hundreds of Verari soldiers on his ships to back the sailors. We never stood a chance in close action. Once they had the basilisk, they stopped taking prisoners. They'd board a ship, scuttle it, and move on to the next. Their archers put shafts into anyone in the water, at least until the devilfish came.
I needed every trick I had just to get the orchid out. A few of us straggled back to Prodigal, beat to hell, and even before we got there, the Verari pounded Montier into the sand. 500 dead in one morning. After that, they sailed back home, and I imagine there was a lot of dancing, fucking, and speeches.
I think,
said Locke. You can take a city like Tal Verar, and you can threaten its purse strings or its pride and get away with it, but not if you threaten both at once.
You're right. Maybe Stragos was impotent when Bonaire left the city. Whatever he was, we united Tal Verar's interests behind him. We summoned him up like some demon out of a story.
She folded her arms over her hat and leaned forward, resting her elbows against the taffrail.
So we stayed outlaws. No flowering of the ghost winds, no glorious destiny for Port Prodigal. This ship is our world now, and I only take her in when her belly's too full to prowl. Am I making myself clear, Orin? I don't regret how I've lived these past few years. I move where I will. I set no appointments, I guard no borders. What land-bound king has the freedom of a ship's captain? The Sea of Brass provides. When I need haste, it gives me winds. When I need gold, it gives me galleons.
Thieves prosper, thought Locke. The rich remember. He made his decision and gripped the rail to avoid shaking.
Only God's damned fools die for lines drawn on maps, said Zemira. But nobody can draw lines around my ship. If they try, all I need to do to slip away is set more sail.
Yeah, said Locke. But, Zemira, what if I were forced to tell you that may no longer be the case?